What is up, everybody? Welcome to The Stack. I'm Alex.
I am Justin.
I'm Pete.
And on The Stack, we talk about a bunch of turkeys.
We give thanks.
Okay, that's what we do.
We give thanks to these comics.
We stuff our faces full of comics is what we do. That's what we're doing for this week. And we review them. So let's get into it. And spoiler warning. Let's dig in.
We're having Stovetop now. And we're having Stovetop again at the end of The Stack.
That's how much
we love Stovetop.
I'm grateful for all the amazing writers and artists that make comic books.
I'll let you know at the end how I feel after we talk about these. So why don't we kick it off, and spoiler warning for everything we're going to talk about in The Stack with a big one, literally, Absolute Batman, number 14 from DC Comics.
Written
by Scott Snyder, art by Nick Dragotta. This is the final fight against Bane as Batman takes him on mano a mano in the middle of Gotham City with a couple of his amazing friends helping out in certain ways. This was crazy highly anticipated. I've never really seen people like this hyped for a 14th issue of something online. like it's wild how much this series has really riled people up. And you get to see, I think, why over the course of this. This is just ludicrous, huge fight throughout. Incredible, crazy things happening as Batman just, they amp it up and then they amp it up more and then they amp it up even more over the course of the fight. They really like double down on this, bringing everything that's happened to the book together. Batman is bringing everything to the fight here, and it ends and includes a few surprises along the way as well. Pete, you seem pretty stoked for this, so what do you think?
Hell yeah. First off, how about that cover? I mean, damn, that's a badass cover. Gets you very excited for what's going to happen on the insides. Yeah, this was insane.
That's a cover. That's a classic cover job right there.
That's right.
And anything else you want to say about this cover specifically? Or
no, it's a sick cover.
I was away last week, so usually we describe the covers and we don't just say cool cover.
No, if you saw, the episode, Alex, it was a 6-minute episode where we were like, sick cover, medium cover. Nah, I could work, do some work on this cover. Cover. Good night.
And people listened to this podcast, you said.
They appreciated.
Anyway, tiny Batman with his bat axe standing on top of an enormous Bane as Wayland, a.k.a. Killer Croc, spirals around him, biting onto him. I agree. It is a sick cover, Pete.
Yeah, I mean, this had me on the edge of my seat. Love the pace of this. Just there was some like small, quick panels in the beginning, kind of like really kind of getting you pumped up. This all comes together in this issue. I had such a blast with this. The art's amazing. The action's so over the top, but so great. This is so worth it. What a cool ride. All 14 of these issues were bangers. I was so excited by the end. I just wanted to go back and reread the whole thing. This is just what a just tentpole, unbelievable thing that DC did here with this Absolute. And this Batman run is going to be legendary and live on. This is just peak comics here. I think this was just such a blast and it's so much fun and such a great use of just kind of turning things up to 11.
It's striking to me how much, just in this issue in particular, that the what this book can get away with. Like, Batman opens his fight with, first off, it's like, they're like, we're shutting down most of Gotham because Batman's fighting his friend, I guess? I don't know. There's a scene where the cops are like, don't go downtown. It's going to be fucked up with a fight. And, like, wild. And then Batman opens his fight by literally dropping a building on Bane.
Yeah, he's like, he does.
I call that Welcome to Gotham. And it's like, and that's the beginning. It's just like, it's so – Scott Snyder is able to put the last line of an action movie onto every page in this book in a crazy way. And then Nick Dragotta's art, the size of Bane by the end of this is absolutely nonsense.
Yeah.
Like, Batman makes his chest emblem into an axe and slices his spine, and he has to jump 3 to 4 floors into the air to slice Bane's back open. And I really like the story-wise, I like the way that Batman won. It's just crazy to me, too. If you, like, woke up in the morning and just looked at page 17 in this, you'd be like, what the fuck? is going on?
It's how I start my day is page 17 now, dude. This is
exactly your living page 17 lifestyle. Yeah. But I guess I'm just saying, like, Scott Snyder is doing, and Nick Dakota are doing absolute magic here by getting us to, like, invest emotionally and narratively in something that is just absolute, the most, like, souped up Mortal Kombat shit in the universe right now.
Yeah, it's, I have a couple of thoughts just off of that. One thing to throw out about Nick Dragota is the variety of different things that he is capable of in this issue alone is very impressive. He's done this throughout the run, but I was just struck by, like, when they sent out the preview, there's that page recapping everything where it's just Batman clearly thinking about what's happened to him and his friends and getting ready for this fight. And it's like 45 panels on one page, but it's so clear the way you're reading it when some artists, and this is not to slag anybody out, but like some artists can't do that with four panels, you know? Like, so that clarity is incredible. And then there's a thing that happens.
Sorry, just on that real quick, Alex, it simultaneously offers clarity and shows the chaotic nature of how Bruce Wayne is feeling. And that's impossible. Right. How is it so clear yet also so chaotic to show how fractured and fucked up he is? That's a mad idea that he was able to contain on this page. Sorry.
Well, and then Bane, over the course of it, gets more and more venomed out, like we're talking about. But it's always, even as he's like this mass of writhing flesh, you can still see what's going on and understand the action. It's clear. And then there's little moments like, this is obviously a big spoiler, but after he beats Bane and Bane is just goop, Batman like gives him like a little kick into the ocean and it
kicks him into the bay.
And it's really funny. Like, it's a funny little kick. So the fact that he can get all of those different tones and ideas and scales across is really impressive. The one other thing that I wanted to throw out there just off of this, like, I completely forgot what tone you just called out, but we were having a little discussion where somebody at our Patreon Discord was asking about, like, why do people say this is manga inflected? And I think this issue brings it home. Like, this is like an Akira fight or whatever else. Yeah. Where
the
just
size differential and the body dysmorphia is what I think is.
And also the insane violence.
Yes.
Yes. And one other thing I want to highlight, Batman won this fight by using all of his friends who are now his rogues to help him. That's really interesting. Yeah. Like, we had the beginning of this arc was about them being turned into monsters by Bane, Batman feeling the guilt of that. Yet they all came together and, you know, Killer Croc, the boxing match that Waylon is fighting is a flashback over the course of this that feels out of place for a lot of the story I found. But then really hammers home when you connect the Waylon fight here and how Waylon is about to be murdered by Bane in full crocodile form. And it's really interesting to me what the superstructure of this story is, especially when I think we have a Wonder Woman crossover coming maybe next month. That, like, this is a much bigger story than it feels like when you're just seeing Batman jam an eyeball out of Bane's head.
While we're continuing to big up this story, Scott Snyder has talked a lot about the impetus behind the Absolute line, as well as DC All In, was, he said this 1 million times. He's even said this to us a couple of times. We're like, he was feeling like people were really down on superheroes, particularly because the movies were seeing a downturn. People were like, whatever, comics, whatever, superheroes. And he wanted to show people with everybody else why superheroes are important, why we care about them. And this issue is a perfect example of this because everything in the issue and everything that's happened to Batman is forcing him into an impossible situation where he has to kill Bane. He has to use Venom, become Bane, become his greatest enemy in order to take him down. And instead, he comes up with another solution. And I'm not going to spoil that here, but just like, it was such a joyful relief when we get to that point where even in this hyper dark side infused negative energy world that the Absolute characters live in, that he does shine through and be a superhero and be better than the villains he's facing. That's great. That is why we read superhero comics.
Well, and I think it's an interesting comp to the DC KO book we're going to talk about a little bit later on. So we should let's put a pin in that to bring it up again.
I would just like to just say that Scott Snyder and Nick Dragota's art is is just so good. And Scott Snyder did it again. Like, he's done so many legendary runs that this is just another banger. It's really impressive what they were able to accomplish with this comic.
And just off what you said, Alex, last thing, like, not only is he bigging up superheroes in this, but he's bigging up comics, I think. Like, there's big upping, I should say. Bigging up is not a word. he's big upping comics. This is, like,
big upping is also not a word.
Okay. You be the judge, listeners. Which one makes more sense for your guy? But I think you couldn't tell this story. Like, even in animation, I think it would be hard to contain all of these ideas in the same way and jumping back and forth between the flashbacks. This is a comics medium story at the top of the...
I want to see an animated version of this comic.
I do, too. But I think Justin's point still stands that this is made for and built for the comic book page. And that's not just why, like you're saying, we love superheroes. This is why we love comics, when it is this melding of the writing and art that's just perfect. Why don't we move on, though? We clearly love this comic.
We do.
The Infernal Hulk, number one for Marvel, written by new Marvel exclusive Philip Kennedy Johnson, art by Nick Klein. This is actually a continuation of his run on Hulk, where Hulk was not killed, but seemingly had his body taken over by Eldest, a demonic-style entity, that's the simplest way of putting it, had Bruce Banner ripped out, and now the Infernal Hulk is coming straight for Earth. Beyond anything else, like, they're creating just a epic horror Hulk run here. It is purposefully really shocking and upsetting, the opposite of what we were talking about there, seeing Hulk actually killing people.
Yeah.
Well, like, this is... I loved this book. I thought this was like such a culmination of what Philip Kennedy Johnson has been doing in his other Hulk work, and setting the stage for what he's moving into next. Like, what a horror book. Like, this has, like, references to, like, classic, like, EC horror, like the soldier who has to come back and is now undead and has to fight his way through. Like, I loved that. The art by, you said, Nick Klein, right? Like, it's unbelievable, the art. Like, the Hulk's body, the just pure horror of it all, the colors are really supporting Nick Klein's art. Like, this was, and that's by Matthew Wilson. Like, man, did I love this. And if you haven't been reading Philip Kennedy Johnson's other stuff on Hulk, you could come in cold on this and still enjoy it. It was really good. I just wanted to shout out one panel at the end where they do a spin around the Marvel Universe of everyone hearing about this Hulk incident that happens. And you just got Spider-Man and Captain America hanging out on the couch.
Yeah.
What do you think? What do you think about that?
Yeah, what was happening there? Where were they? It was like they were at a flop house. They had just finished doing heroin and were hanging out.
They're on a roof, and Cap looks fucked up, and Spider-Man's sitting upside down on the couch. And I agree with you. They look like they're just like... the edibles hitting for both of them.
It
and
I'm seems like they were watching a Mets game to me.
Interesting. I guess you are a Mets fan now. We have to say that now.
Nope, that's not true.
Why'd you say Mets?
Well, because when you see somebody who maybe looks a little left up, I think, oh, they're probably watching the Mets game.
Well, because Yankees fans are sober AF?
Sober AF, dude. Just ready, locked in.
Not my experience.
Not mine either. I think this is unbelievable. This is so badass and fucked up. I mean, the art is just top notch. I mean, Hulk is just like thunderclapping dudes' brains out their head. That shit was crazy. We kind of got a Hulk King of the Monsters situation. He's sitting on top of a skull throne. This is like Conan the Barbarian, but more evil and fucked up. So I cannot wait to see what's going to happen after this. This is a solid first issue. It does such a great job of setting things up. And, man, it's only going to get darker and more fucked up. So I cannot wait for this ride. Buckle up. This is going to be a blast.
And I'll just mention, when Pete and I talked to Philip back at Baltimore Comic Con before this launched, he was mentioning one of the challenges with Infernal Hulk is with their previous Hulk run, he and Nick Klein had always tried to aim for a gross transformation scene every issue. Infernal Hulk doesn't transform. It's just the Hulk body. And he was trying to figure out how could they still make it gross. I think mission accomplished. They made it pretty gross.
It's definitely gross.
No hey, question. Let's talk about another gross book, Pete. What do you say? Berserker, The Bleeding Tide, number one from Boom Studios, written by Marjorie Liu, art by Gary Brown. If you're not familiar with Berserker, this is a property co-created with Keanu Reeves, and it looks a lot like Keanu Reeves. He is an immortal warrior throughout time that has a bloodlust that cannot be satiated, and also he can't die. In this one, he gets picked up by a vampire pirate queen. Should just also mention they have different creative teams who are coming in and doing a bunch of different one shots. So this falls under the realm of that. As usual with this, all of these have been great. All of these one shots, I think, like they all have very specific tone. It's Marjorie Liu, so you're getting a little bit of like the fantastical fairy tales type, dark fairy tale type stuff, which is great. There's a lot more mysticism in this one than we've gotten in this series previously, but I think it fit perfectly. I loved it. Great, malleable character they've created here.
Yeah, this is touching and kind of fun to team up a evil vampire with an immortal god here. And they're just admiring their rage that they both have and how well they can fight. And, this was, like, a touching story, which you don't get a lot with Berserker.
Does a read like this, Pete, make you, like, change the way you feel about, like, romance, rom-coms, your own dating life?
I don't know about all that, but it definitely gets me excited to read some rom-coms and go check them out. Because just like any love story, you know, it's two opposites, you know, maybe finding each other.
Read some you're reading romance novels?
Always.
Yeah. Pete prints out the transcript of like from Netflix of like When Harry Met Sally and whatever. He doesn't even get the script version. He just gets like the closed captions and prints them out.
Oh yeah,
he just reads them.
Yeah,
you read them a lot at your local style. At your local coffee shop, is that what you do? You read those a lot?
Like sure.
A beat poet.
Yeah.
In southeastern Pennsylvania.
That's right.
For my open mic performance, I'm going to do Sleepless in Seattle.
Nice. Dude, I bet you would kill.
What an affair to remember. I enjoyed this as well. Great. The first like 7-8 pages, the discovery of our guy being
so gross.
It was very gross, but awesome. I thought it was just a great way in. I feel like that's what's great about Berserker is like because he's immortal and indestructible, you have these tentpole ideas. But you can get so creative with how we come in on him, what the story is. There's a little bit of a romance angle here. There's a little bit of a, like, who are we to each other and what do we mean to each other, which I thought was cool. I would like to see a continuation of not only Berserker, but these two characters together.
Yeah, definitely.
Next up, DC KO, number two from DC Comics, written by Scott Snyder and Joshua Williamson, art by Javi Fernandez and Zermanico. The DC Universe has been taken over by Darkseid. In order to stop him, the heroes and unfortunately some villains have headed into a tournament held by the Heart of Apocalypse to determine who will become King Omega, the person who could take down Darkseid. But there's a bunch of twists and turns, as we found on the first issue, including those aforementioned villains. So now we are down to 32 contenders who are entering the ring in this issue. They are given 16 artifacts they have to find. Once the 16 artifacts are found, those 16 contenders continue. Everybody else, quote unquote, dies. And the tournament continues from there. Meanwhile, on the outside, there's some shenanigans going on with Booster Gold, who is secretly Darkseid, as we found out, which we get a follow-up in this issue as well. Justin, I'm curious to hear from you first, because it sounded like you had some hot takes on this issue.
Yeah, JT says...
Well, it's interesting in comparison to the Batman issue.
Right,
the actual Batman issue that we read where Batman figures it out by not becoming the evil thing that he's fighting. This story feels like, and it's not that I'm down on it. I mean, it's the same writer. So, like, I feel like it's, you can't be like, this one guy blew it. But, like, it is interesting that in this issue, Superman is like essentially making the choice to become Darkseid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And setting up, and at the end, spoiler, we get Booster Gold as Darkseid entering the tournament. So, like,
Is that cheating?
Yes. It's like the ref being like, fuck this, I'm playing football.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems very
unfair.
I don't watch a lot. Does that ever happen? Because I feel like you get frustrated. You'd be like, I know the rules.
At this than these guys. A lot of times, like, the owners will come, like Jerry Jones from the Cowboys will come down. He'll take a couple snaps, throw the ball around a little bit.
No, that doesn't happen.
I know in wrestling, that happens all the time. The owners come in and they fight, right? Like, that's a real sport.
That's true, but those guys are also wrestlers. That's a place where the lunatics also own the asylum. I like this. I like the crossover. I like this issue. It's playing out in a wildly different way. It's moving faster than I thought it would. And can we recheck our brackets? Do the brackets matter?
I guess not. I mean, I have them.
We should check them.
Yeah. Should we do it? I can...
Yeah, I'd just like to talk a little bit about this. This is, first off, cool-looking cover, very kind of crazy, gets you excited to read. Tons of action. I'm really impressed with the pace of this. The fun wild card with the mystery item. And then the amount of time we get with Lex and Supes is really impressive. Also, fun Joker kind of cameo in this. Yeah, I just really was impressed with not only the art but the action. This is a blast. Lobo kind of getting Venom was awesome. Yeah, I just think that, like, they're really delivering on this, and I'm surprised at how quickly we're blowing through stuff, but I'm also excited about the pace because it means to me we're getting to something even cooler.
How about Superman losing a hand?
Yeah.
B, Thor's hammer being included? Not necessary. Yep. Sort of not. Yep. What
Not
you do
what
at DC.
We're doing here. Yeah.
Weird thing to have hanging out there, but okay. The use of Joker here I thought was excellent.
Yes.
Really love all of that. There's a badass nature to this whole thing. There's a fun vibe to it that they've been able to suffuse through the whole crossover that I think is excellent. And you can really feel it in the pages here. And there's another issue we're going to talk about that sort of opens up some of the moments here. But this is really, I'm really enjoying it. And a lot of people are down on the interstitials where the Trinity are playing the board game. Mm-hmm. I like them. I think they give
like
us a
too.
Little bit of baseline.
You were spot on with the first issue in terms of that laying out everything that's happened in the issue. And I think since Scott Snyder has been like, this lays out everything that's happening in the series, and you'll continue to see it throughout. And it totally makes sense. Just to throw out there, like, real quick, I really like this. Like, I really like this crossover a lot. This is going in some absolutely wild directions, and I'm having a lot of fun with it. I did pull up the bracket if we want to take a look at them. Do we want to look at them now? Let's see how we're doing. I'll move our heads.
But how do we know? I guess we just have to see.
So this is mine. Mm-hmm. And we got, this is down to the 16. So Superman, Captain Atom, I was spot on with that. That's the, we're getting that face off.
Yep. Yes.
Firestorm, Cheetah, I think way off there.
Yep.
Aquaman, Hawkman.
Aquaman,
unclear.
Hawkman in.
Okay, Lex Luthor, Supergirl, I was right there. Wonder Woman, Plastic Man, nope, Plastic Man, he dead.
Yep.
Swamp Thing and Cyborg. Cyborg is definitely
Still in it, yeah.
Swamp Thing, did Vixen
He's in.
Okay. Then we got Batman, way wrong there, and Wonder Woman. Damian Wayne. They're both out.
Jason Todd. Yep.
Yeah.
Batman's gone.
Barda and Harley Quinn. Barda's gone. Harley's still in.
Okay.
Yep. This next one, this is yours, Justin. You got Superman, Captain Atom, Firestorm, Jay Garrick.
Jay Garrick in, Firestorm.
Okay. Out. Aquaman, Hawkman, Lightning, Supergirl. So for like 50-50 there. Wonder Woman, Lobo. Yep. Spot on with that one. Yep. Swamp Thing, Batwoman.
No Batwoman.
No Batwoman. Batman, we were also wrong. Red Hood, you're right about Red Hood. And Barda and Harley Quinn. So, all right.
Similar.
Here's Peach, just to round it up. We got Superman, Power Girl.
Nope. Superman in, but he's mad. Power Girl, no.
Yep. Firestorm, Cheetah. No.
Nope, neither.
Aquaman, Hawkman. Black Lightning, the Demon. Sorry, buddy.
Yeah. Demon dead.
Wonder Woman,
Demon
Lobo.
Dead. Oh, no, Demon in. Demon in.
Oh, Demon, sorry, in. Demon in. Oh, that's right. Yeah. Demon's facing off Lex Luthor, I think. Nope. Wonder Woman, Lobo. Swamp Thing, Batwoman. Batman, nope. Red Hood. That really messed us up. And Barda, Harley Quinn.
Meh.
All right.
But I think technically, though, I mean, Joker took the Batman spot. That was a spoiler.
Okay.
So, like, I guess...
Are we counting that? So, like, it would have been...
No, we couldn't have gotten... Like, there's right. No win there. So, right. It's still an L, but, like, you guys who had Batman go further are going to be punished more.
Yes, yeah. And I don't have our overall one, which I should have brought up as well, but this is fine.
It's good. I mean, I feel like we're pretty evenly matched,
yeah.
Weirdly. In different areas.
Anyway, we'll keep checking in with that. That's a good idea. I'll keep that around. But yeah, I'm really enjoying this crossover. We'll be talking more about it later in the
staff. All fight month, I believe, coming up.
It's coming up.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Ooh. Daredevil and Punisher, The Devil's Trigger, number one for Marvel, written by Jimmy Palmiotti, art by Tommaso Bianchi. Once again, Daredevil and Punisher are on a rooftop debating ethics, as they are wont to do. This takes place back in the day, and it is, in fact, Daredevil trying to stop Punisher, getting chained up, put a gun in his head, and all he's got to do is shoot Punisher to stop him from shooting somebody else. What happens next from there? Pete, you're our Punisher guy. What'd you think?
Yeah, to tell you the truth, I don't know how I feel about this.
Whoa.
Punisher kind of sets up Daredevil to watch him kill somebody. And that was just kind of weird for me. And then he's like, Punisher's like, yeah, and then I'm going to have Daredevil sit through all these mob meetings. And I have a hard time sitting through meetings, even if it's mob related. So I
was like, great revenge.
Yeah.
And imagine then, if I tied you up and you had to listen to like.
That would be my personal hell. But yeah, and then there's this weird panel where it like shows Punisher's head in the sky and it's the Twin Towers. And I'm like, why are we doing a 9/11 thing right now? So
do you think that's going to happen? Is that how it's going to turn out? Where Punisher would be like, I'm going to do 9/11 unless you stop me.
Oh, God. Yeah, so this was a really weird.
He's like, there's a mafia on one floor in this building. I'll kill everyone.
Yeah, this is a really weird setup for me where I'm not sure what's going on and why Punisher is just trying to push Daredevil to the dark side.
This is like a classic "your one bad day for Big B" conversation. This was just extrapolating on it. That's what it's
very doing. Much out of the TV series. I felt like this okay. issue.
Well, but that's a line. That's a comic. Like that was. I'm forgetting what issue it is, but they already did this once. This is taking that and turning it into a miniseries.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Here's a line that stuck out to me, and let me know what you think about this. This is Daredevil talking to the mob guy that he's trying to save. But let's also keep in mind, these mafioso guys are like, you're cartoons. You're like Sopranos times Sopranos. You're like Scooby-Doo villain level. But anyway, this is that line Daredevil says. And Punisher means business and knows this city better than anyone. I'm like, really? Punisher knows this city?
Punisher knows New York City pretty well. Who do you think knows it better?
Daredevil.
Anyone?
Punisher just drives a taxi cab driver.
Any Uber driver, Spider-Man, Daredevil, Luke Cage. Why is Punisher so good at the city? He doesn't do anything. Is he going to the museum? Probably. All that dude is like, he's hiding in a basement all the time.
Nobody knows the best discounts in Times Square like the Punisher.
Yeah. The Punisher, yeah, he knows all the best Margarita deals at the Applebee's. I don't know. The Punisher in this book feels a little bit different than the Punisher I expect.
Agreed.
And so that's what I was feeling.
All right, fair enough. Moving on, Universal Monsters, The Invisible Man, number 4 from Skybound at Image Comics, written by James Tynion IV, art by Danny. In this issue, Danny, the Invisible Man becomes invisible as we finally wrap it up, and he becomes murderous as well. I would say overall, this has been, all of these series have been good at differing levels, but the art in particular here is absolutely gorgeous in this series. It's very tense as it's rolled out, and I thought it tied up very nicely in this issue.
I agree with you. It's hard to really be like, yeah, he finally turns invisible in like sort of the back half of the fourth issue and be like, it was awesome. But it was. Like, I liked the way it was set up really effectively. There's a character, a kid, I think his name is Tommy, who is turned invisible in the previous issue, and there's a paranoia aspect to the story here, and then a becoming the thing that you dream of, and then it being a curse and having to find your next way. It's surprisingly set up for a sequel series, I feel like, pretty effectively, where we get to see him be invisible more and be a sociopath.
Well,
I hope.
This is just my guess, because to be honest, I'm not very familiar with the old Universal Monster movie, but I think this ends where that starts, is my assumption, but I could be wrong.
Or maybe a little bit, because I feel like he has to start visible in the movie. this is coming up. It feels a bit prequel-y, this, but not in a way that is like harming the story. It's a big psychological profile, essentially, of this guy who is a straight-up sociopath. I would like to see him just in action more. And I have felt similarly about the Dracula story. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like it was a lot of like world building around, but we didn't get to see the story as much.
I really like this. The art was unbelievable. I like the twists and turns, poor blonde lady. But I also thought they did some interesting ideas, like this idea of like someone thinking that like, oh man, wouldn't it be cool if you could turn invisible, and then somebody being like, that's the worst thing you can do is take away their visibility. So it's an interesting idea, and I think played with well in this issue. So. Sure. I think Danny killed it on the art.
What do you think? Would you want to be invisible?
Hell yeah, dude. That'd be awesome.
You go for it?
Really?
Yeah. Even despite the issue saying, please don't do this. This is very bad.
Oh, my God. Just the free donuts alone would be worth it.
You could get the powder all over your fingers. You're busted.
Right. That's terrible.
Come on, dude.
That's
not my first.
Bad choice immediately.
Dude, I'm not eating powdered donuts. I'm eating glazed donuts.
Also, I don't know
donuts.
If they're free so much as you are stealing donuts, is what you're saying?
Yeah, I'm just saying. Nobody...
that's not free. That's stealing.
Pete, you would be busted immediately as
no
being
way.
Invisible. On every... You'd be like, this naked dude is here. He's invisible. He wants donuts and beer, probably. Just throw some flour in the air. He's caught.
Yeah, you can tell him by the big garbage plate stain running down his
face. He's covered in mustard. He thinks he's invisible, but he's got ketchup all over his face.
He's covered in buffalo sauce, probably. Oh, all right. Absolute Wonder Woman, number 14 from DC Comics, written by Kelly Thompson, art by Matias Bergara. This is the second part of a storyline that finds Wonder Woman battling what seems to be the Earth's reaction to her evil opposite. And in the middle of this, Absolute Zatanna enters and casts a little bit of a spell on her.
Tricky.
Leading to the tee-up to the crossover with Absolute Batman. Pete, you're a big Absolute Wonder Woman dude. What'd you think?
Yeah, absolutely love this. Cool cover.
Amazing cover. I love this cover. I thought it was such a great like zoom in. I just thought it was really cool.
Yeah, it does a great job of being intriguing, making you wanting to open it up and read what's inside. Yeah,
really spent a lot of time explaining what a cover is in this and every episode of the stack. Really,
that's what I'm into.
It's
into
a close up of Wonder Woman's chest symbol with her fists coming into it, and she's leaning in. I agree. The angle, in particular, she's leaning makes you lean forward at the same time. So, agreed. Great
dynamic.
Cover. And thank you guys for your deep description of it as well.
Yeah, never do it. I'm excited to see what's happening next, but also just like, this was very cool. I mean, you know, I like this idea of Wonder Woman being like, you know, I've got friends. You know, I can call and work some shit off. You know, when things get too hectic, just run down to hell, get some buddies, and then come back up and be like, who are you talking to? That's what I thought. You know what I mean?
She didn't go down to hell.
I don't think that's
quite what happened.
But I did really like
I'm summing it up and making some creative choices, but it's basically what happened.
You're making creative choices.
Yeah.
Great.
Good.
That's really good. Feel like they did that in the comic, or did you feel like you needed to add your creative choices up to the comic?
Well, you know, I feel cornered. But...
Sure. So she goes into the center of the Earth and visits Gaia. Also, her friends are not in hell. They're on the surface of the Earth, but sure. That's
kind of what I said.
In a way. In a good way. And people can just rewind 30 seconds and really... check that. I thought this was great. Like, it's amazing that this comic is able to be poignant. Like, the poignancy of Wonder Woman's conversation with Gaia and the way that she solves her problem, similar to the way that Batman does it, like, outsmarts the situation, I thought was really cool.
Yeah.
I love the cast and the tension around Wonder Woman feels stressed after she beats this. She has, like, essentially a doppelganger. Because she's good, there has to be, and she's created by magic, there has to be an evil to balance out the magical equation, essentially. And Wonder Woman goes to Gaia and says, like, hey, the world's fucked up, so, like, that balances me. You can get rid of this monster here. And it just happens. Like, I love that. It's very mythological, logic, which I thought is just what this book needs. But then Wonder Woman goes back to everyone else and is like, fuck, okay, we got to do a lot going on here. her level of stress is high. And that's, you know, I don't know if that sounds pleasurable to read if you're not doing it, but it just leads to more potential great story coming down the line.
A couple of things that I really liked in this issue, and I love every issue of this book, but... like you were saying, Justin, there's this sense throughout the Absolute line that they're slowly, the heroes are starting to come out with, like, this world is not right. Like, there are things that are not right here. And I like it because it's rolling out in a way that feels like it serves the story they're telling first. For example, in this case, what's happening to Absolute Wonder Woman versus we're laying out and leading up to a big event. It's not about the thing happening down the road. It's about the thing happening right now. And I think that's the way it should work.
I would push that one step further and be like, I read it as a commentary on our world.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it works on those multiple levels, which is amazing. That's awesome.
Yeah. And the other thing, Zatanna. So backward speak, as I mentioned many times on this podcast, drives me insane. Like, I cannot deal with it. Here, I thought it was perfect. And it was perfect because not only did it tie into the overall plot of this is the opposite of Diana showing up on Earth. So here we have a magic user who talks completely backwards. But I thought the way that Kelly Thompson wrote it as her repeating this binding, this spell, and also sticking with the backward speak rather than like, I'm Zatanna, I talk normally unless I want to make spells when I talk backwards. That instead, this seems to be somebody that is part of that opposite part of the world from Diana, I thought was nice. And then the other little part of it is, like, there's a sick amount of heat between those two characters. Like, they clearly, like, Zatanna, when she comes here, is like, ooh, those eyes give a kick, don't you? I was like, okay, all right.
Yeah, we got something happening right here.
Something's heating up. Let's go. Make it happen. So, great comic. Really, really good.
Yes.
The Mortal Thor, number 4 from Marvel, written by Al Ewing, art by Juan Cabal. In this issue, we very surprisingly take a break from the ongoing plot where Thor is on Earth with no memory to be like, oh yeah, everybody on Asgard does remember Thor, and here's a fun adventure with Ulick the Troll.
And here's another guy who's just like Thor, like basically Thor. Like we just spent only three issues with, like, hey, this construction worker is pretty good with a hammer, and then they're like, but you remember Thor, right? Well, here's him, except his hair's a little browner,
right? But also it's He-Man, basically. Like, this issue is straight up 100% was a Masters of the Universe issue. For what it was, like, on its own, I thought Al Ewing made it a very fun Saturday morning cartoon inflected adventure, but I wish we hadn't gotten it. You know what I mean? Because, like, I liked where we were going, and I was intrigued at the mystery and the fact that they're like, Asgard maybe doesn't exist. I don't know. Maybe Thor doesn't exist. Who's know? And now we cut over to people being like, yes, we remember Thor and he died and here's what happened. I'm like, no. Leave the mystery going for a little bit longer. That's all.
Well, but here's the thing. I get that because it did feel like a strong departure. But what I think Al Ewing is doing here is taking sort of the original text of Thor and being like, he had to be immortal on Earth, and play it sort of a little bit harder, like really committing to it. Like, Thor has to be immortal on Earth, and like, it sucks more than it you had to the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're showing how myths will continue without Thor, and they are goofy, they're like simple, and there's like, I think it's highlighting or pushing further apart the actual story, you know, story tent poles of that original Thor narrative. So, like, I think that's interesting. It just is, he's coy. He's being coy here. So, like, I believe that's what it is, and I hope that's what it adds up to be.
I was confused, and I was like, what happened to the construction guy? What's going on with this? So I was a little lost, but also I thought this was a fun issue. I just wasn't sure how this fit into the construction guy, but, great art, tons of action, and, kind of sweet to see kind of brown-haired Thor, at the hall having fun.
Pete, if you miss construction, come to New York. My brother works in construction. You can come down to the site and really see some guys swing some hammers.
Oh, by sweet, the way, man. It, just to be clear, it is not brown-haired Thor. It is Thor's son.
Yeah. But from another dimension, right? Yeah. Another reality, yep. I believe.
So, son from another dimension.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Feral, number 18 from Image Comics, written by Tony Fleece, art by Trish Forstner and Tone Rodriguez. Last issue, our cats managed to take over Pet City and flip the dynamic there. And now they're dealing with the fallout. Of course, as usual, things are only getting worse as a really misogynist cat has taken over everything. Yeah. What'd you guys think of this one?
This is what broke me. I couldn't. It was funny because.
Broke you? Wow.
Yeah. I saw Tony Fleece and Fleece at the Baltimore Comic Con. I had a nice little moment with him. And I was like, man, I can't believe I'm still in on this Feral thing. He was like, yeah, me either. And this is the one that broke me, man. This was too fucked up. And.
I'm sorry. What part? I'm so sorry. They had 3 issues about eating fetal baby cats. That was not the thing that broke you. Yeah. This is the issue that broke
this
you.
Is the issue. The fact that they're staying in this horrible place and then are going to be even worse. And that whole, like, it was just, there's a lot that goes down that's really fucked up in this issue, and I just couldn't.
I think maybe you were just concerned with the fact that we learned here that cat sex has cat consequences. So, Pete, take that to heart.
Oh,
you can't
thanks.
Puff the fluff without having to, puff the
rough
rest
the
of
tough,
your life.
Rough the tough.
Yeah, you got to rough the tough. You puff the fluff, you got to rough the tough. Thank you, Alex.
Anytime. That's what we're here for.
That's what we're here for, is to speak absolute nonsense. this book is great. Like, they're able to, despite this being like a full Bluth cartoon from the 80s, it still has so much emotionality, so much like stress.
So much darker than any Bluth cartoon. Like, what the fuck?
Well, I don't know. That shit is dark. Like, I love The Secret of Nim. That era, mm-hmm. There's great stuff in there, and it's dark. And that's what we're getting here. But still telling, like, a better than a lot of the seasons of Walking Dead zombie story.
Mm-hmm.
We get a zombie coming back alive in the middle of this book, and that is barely registering on the most stressful things that are happening in this comic. So it's such a layered story. So many characters, but they're all distinct. And I have no idea what's going to happen.
Yeah, same here. Agreed. I'll also throw out, I love that there's a scene where we cut to some humans being like, it's on at the Pet City. I don't know if I want to go over there. And then we never see them again. Maybe we will see them again, but I do love the idea that it's like the world's worst things are happening to these cats, and that's the action we're following, while the humans are like, some cats are being weird, you know?
Well, it does feel like, because that scene was very interesting, instructive, I think, to what the series is. It feels like in this city, mm-hmm. there was a zombie outbreak, or pets became zombies. And so these guys are like, ugh, what a long day. We got to kill all these pets, mm-hmm. essentially. And so that's maybe the world that we don't realize is happening around these characters.
Yeah. Batman, Green Arrow, The Question, Arcadia, number one from DC Comics by Gabriel Hardman, both on writing and art. Per the title, this is bringing the three characters together, and this is supposed to be somewhat inspired by classic crossovers of, like, the 80s. I'm forgetting there was one that crossed over at least two of these characters before. I'm blanking on it. I'm sorry. But here we get a little bit of an environmental mystery that embroils Green Arrow, Question, and Batman all in different aspects, bringing them to conflict. I really dug this a lot. I was looking forward to this. I was very intrigued, but went in some very surprising directions because it is so very specifically set in a place in DC continuity that, frankly, I don't know. I was not reading comics at this time, but it brings you into the status quo for Green Arrow, the status quo for Question, and the status quo for Batman that are all different, all coming at this problem from different directions, giving them all distinct personalities. What I think a lot of times people will write it as like, yeah, there's Batman, and then there's Batman with no face, and also Batman, but he shoots arrows, you know? So, like, to come up with them very distinctly with their own different drives and MOs, I thought was pretty great. Plus, you get some really, really good superhero art throughout here.
Yeah. What I loved about this, what you're describing, Alex, is the differences in socioeconomic status is played mm-hmm. out a lot here, where Bruce Wayne, obviously rich, able to do what he wants. Green Arrow is like, oh, I used to own that company, but I don't anymore. I get a stipend. Like, they literally say these things. And then the Question is like, I have basically nothing. I have a roommate who, like, is offering me tips at a point. So, like, that's interesting. That really is the defining quality between the three of them. This reminded me of Lazarus, the book, the Greg Rucka book that we talk about a lot, mm-hmm. in the way that it is just very definitively plotted. The art is sort of in the same world as Michael Lark on the Lazarus book. And that's really cool. Like, this was like just a perfect, it really hit me as something I very pleasantly surprised by and loved.
Yeah. Speaking of the art, I thought it was worth it for the panels of the Batcave alone. I mean, really some amazing art, and we get to kind of like see inside the Batcave and some cool panels for sure. Yeah. Tons of action, Ali being a douche. I'm excited for more of this. I really like this. I thought they did such a great job of setting everything up and getting you kind of into what's happening and into this world. So, yeah.
Ali being a douche. I thought he was being sort of cool.
I don't know if I agree with that.
I will say, just last note that I'll say about this, I really like the designs for the bat costumes throughout here.
Yes, there's
some really
agreed.
Fun ones. They felt like whenever a Batman movie would come out and there'd be like 30 different Batmans that never show up at the movie, you'd be like, cool, Frost Armor Batman, awesome. Yeah. So that just on a very visceral level, I was like, this looks good. This is fun. Yeah. Marvel Knights, The Punisher, number two from Marvel, written by Jimmy Pamiotti, art by Dan Panosian. And this takes place in the world to come part of the Marvel Universe, which is the near future when Fred Castle is older. He has been corrupted by a mod boss who has turned him into El Zombie, a brainless enforcer. But in this issue, of course, Punisher keeps breaking out of it and wrecking havoc. Pete, you were already kind of down on one Jimmy Pabiotti Punisher book this week. How did you feel about the second
one? Take here?
Yeah, this is tough because it's, you know, it's not Punisher. It's just like, he's a kind of a toy zombie killer that kind of gets controlled. So, yeah, hopefully, I'll keep reading this, and hopefully the Punisher will break out of this spell and be able to punish those who tried to control him. But we will see. He's not kind of working the joysticks in this, so it's not as enjoyable.
Who's working the joysticks on Pete LePage is the real question. Wow, 0-2.
0-2.
Punisher.
Yeah,
and how are you feeling? I mean, this is side, but over in Benjamin Percy's Punisher Red Band, Punisher also doesn't have his brain and is being controlled by the Kingpin.
Yeah, he went up to two guys driving a van. It was like, could you guys do surgery on my brain?
Yeah, it's a tough time right now, but hey, man, I'm gonna stick with it. You know.
Yeah. For everybody.
Do you feel like
really,
yeah, we're all struggling with the Punisher mostly. Do you feel like it's a telling sign that people are like, the Punisher can't just do stuff. He has to be, someone has to be driving him.
Yeah, it's not a good...
it's a bad time.
Yeah.
Well, let me ask you, I'm not as big of a Punisher fan. Like, usually he has that rat under his hat who's driving him by pulling his hair, right? So, like, how is this different? Like, how is this any different?
You're thinking of Ratatouille. Punisher isn't
right,
a rat.
Like the sound he makes when he shoots a gun. Like, Ratatouille, Ratatouille.
Yeah, that's what it's based on. And I believe the story is that his rat family was murdered underneath a picnic basket.
Oh, my God.
Because they were eating.
You guys are getting it.
I'm sorry. Did this rat learn
karate?
Did
something happen to you guys? I know you lost a beard, but did you lose part of your mind as well? Like, I don't know what's happening.
I don't know. You're the expert, so I'm just asking you. Whether the rat that controls the Punisher learned karate before or after his family was killed under a picnic basket.
You guys are combining way too many things. And that's Yogi. Yogi has nothing to do with...
It's actually... Punisher have often very short hair, much harder to drive when the hair is shorter.
Well, that's it's a very talented rat.
Very talented rat driving the Punisher.
Wait, you're thinking a rat has to be more talented if it's shorter hair than with longer hair? Yeah.
It's like driving a tiny steering wheel.
Yeah.
And like a clown car. You have to be a very good driver if the steering wheel is
right. The reason it worked in Ratatouille, just to break this and be honest with you for a little bit, is
because his
hair was long, so he was able to pull it back and forth.
Pull subtly.
Under the chef's hat.
Different levers.
Yeah, did you guys read this comic or
I didn't? But I did watch Ratatouille.
That's
what's driving this.
Yeah,
is a rat driving this conversation? I want to shout out Dan Podosian's art, which I thought was really good here. Like, and I don't care who's driving the Punisher. I thought this was an interesting story,
and
I think the art was a great reflection of the Punisher being like real down and out.
I actually like this. Like, like the idea that they cannot keep the Punisher down, and he keeps breaking out, being like, what's happening? What's going on here? And immediately starts murdering people as hard as he can. That seems very true to the Punisher to me, not to disagree with you, Pete.
No, that's fine.
Geiger, number 18 from Ghost Machine at Image Comics, written by Jeff Johns, art by Eduardo Pinsica and Gary Frank. As we saw last issue, Geiger has lost his radioactive powers and been sent to prison. In this issue, a bunch of folks try to break into the prison, and it goes predictably wrong in a way inspired by Shocker, the classic horror movie from the 80s or 90s. I don't remember which one. That's the one it was. Wes Craven's Shocker, where the guy gets electric powers, I believe.
I think that's it. No, I think of Ernest Goes to Jail.
Yeah, I think that's what it is. Ernest Goes to Jail.
Both movies.
That was quite shocking to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I thought this was really cool. Kind of fun use of him getting his powers back through the electric chair, which sounds very creepy to say out loud, but fun in this comic and setting. It's nice to see him glowing green and getting all powered up. One man's treasure is another man's trash, you know? I mean, baseball glove and a drawing might mean nothing to one person, but means everything to the other, so.
Wow, Pete really hooking into the emotional tether of this issue. Shouts to that. I just think Jeff Johns' work on his Ghost Machine comics just feels like such a notch up from what he's been doing in the last few years. You can tell he really loves these comics, loves these characters. I'm all in on Red Coat especially, but I thought this was a great issue of Geiger, and he's building up the sort of epic, mythological storytelling of this. I definitely made fun of the fact that it feels like we're constantly retelling Geiger's origin story a lot like the Punisher, but like this issue really worked for building it up with the situation as opposed to just flashing back. So I thought that's a nice change.
And it was Wes Craven's Shocker and came out in 1989. Moving on, Superman number 32 from DC Comics, written by Joshua Williamson, art by Eddie Barrows and Eber Ferreira. This is a DC KO tie-in And a bunch of stuff going on here. First, we pick up with Superboy Prime and Lois Lane, who has Superwoman powers again, fighting against Darkseid's Legion in the Fortress of Solitude. Then we go into the tournament to find out more about Lex Luthor and how the villains ended up there. So it's that part was very interesting to me because it contradicts the information that we got in DC KO number 2. Clearly, Lex Luthor is lying in that issue, but it's very surprising to read them in that order because they're almost opposites in terms of the plot. But in general, I really like what's going on here. Joshua Williamson is really obviously involved in everything that's going on in DC KO, and both parts of the issue I thought were a lot of fun with some big surprises and reveals.
I mean, this does a great job of fleshing out moments, adding, being very additive to the main title while also fleshing out moments. It keeps a nice tether to the spine of the story, which, like, you know, if there was like another crossover at like another comic company that might be struggling with this very thing, I don't know if we'll ever cover that on this podcast, but it is something to think about because I think they're doing a good job in the DC KO crossover of using this issue to give us more, to offer variation, continue the tone of like, hey, this is pretty badass, but switch perspectives. We get a lot more Lex here, like you were saying, Alex, and that's good. I think it's really good.
Yeah, I thought this was a fantastic issue, really just kind of badass stuff. A lot of shit gets crazy in this. But, yeah, I was a little confused because I read KO first, and I was like, wait, this seems to be contradicting. But then I was like, oh, okay. But, yeah, cool, fun. You know, Lex Luthor's a liar and a villain for a reason. So, you know, yeah, kind of fun to get his plans and stuff like that in this issue.
And now the revelation is upon us as we once again enter the X-Men Age of Revelation with not one, Age not two, Revelation. Not three, not four, but four titles coming out this week. I thought there was one more. So let's go through them. Let's talk about them, starting out with, not to tip the hand too much, but I believe Justin's favorite, Cloak or Dagger. Number 2 from Marvel, written by Justina Ireland, art by Lorenzo Tomeda. In the future world of Age of Revelation, Cloak and Dagger are sharing the same body, and not only that, they have a kid who is inside their shared mind space, and they're going up against Fenris, the twins who want to do something. I honestly forgot what they wanted to do. But Justin, what did you think about this?
They're trying to infect humans with the virus so there can be more mutants and stuff because they love that. I just think this is an excellent use of Cloak and Dagger. I like their relationship is advanced. It's not just an unending will they, won't they that I feel like has been part of their continuity for so long. This is just excellent. I want this as an ongoing series. It's one of my definitely top three from the Age of Revelation books. I feel like the characters are so clear. I don't mind that they're barely involved with the main story. What is involved in the main story? Answer me that. Riddle me that. So this is just a fun story in this universe. It is able to be a little bit different and more creative because it's part of this crossover. But I think this should be the main continuity for these characters.
Yeah, I agree in the fact that this is awesome. I just think that, you know, if you're going to be a parent, you got to get on the same page. You know what I mean? Because one parent can't be like, you can't just be like, hey, keep the kid in this other dimension and keep him safe. And then it's like, oh, you can't just bring the kid to the fight and think that's going to be cool. You know, like it's just it makes one parent feel really horrible about the decisions that they're making. You know what I mean? So that's just
a lot of parenting, Pete. You're right. Is choosing the right dimension for your kid at the right time.
I bet.
My kids are right up here in the old noggin.
Oh, yeah. Wow, that's nice.
During the stack, Alex? That seems risky.
Yeah, that does seem...
It's past their bedtime. Don't even worry about it.
I hope so.
Well, yeah, and all that, I think this is kind of a fun exploration of this or idea, where it's like you can't get both of them, but you can get one at a time. So I feel like the next issue will really kind of set things up because what are you going to do? How are you going to protect your kid if they're at the fight? You know what I mean?
It's not going to set things up. Next issue is the last issue.
well, I'm excited to see what's going to happen. You know, you brought a kid to a fight. You know, does the kid join in?
Don't bring a kid to a knife fight. That's what I always say.
Yeah.
Well, that's what they're doing in this issue.
I generally like this. I do like the concept, but my thought about every single one of these this week and in general about this event is most of these need way more room than they're getting. Like, the fact that this is set up, this wild new status quo for Cloak and Dagger, they changed it this issue, and then next issue is the last issue, is very weird to me. It's too rushed.
A larger sort of comment on the event and this crop in general. Like, with a lot of like events like this, all the ancillary titles are pointed in toward the spine books, where it's like, we are part of this main story and we're fleshing out an aspect, moving the story forward, or explaining something else. All of these books are positioned and looking outward, where they're like, here's our thing, we're fighting Fenris, and has no real relation to Revelation. And, like, we'll see this as we go through. They're all sort of like, well, what we're fighting is insert random X-Men villain or hero or whatever. And it just feels a little bit like not enough there's not enough glue to bind all this together. It feels extremely random. And I think that shows in the way we feel about these books, where it's like, ooh, I like this one. I don't like this one. It's such a light switch of like good, bad, as opposed to like, oh, this is cool. I wish it was a little bit more blank. Like, it's left us a little cold, hot and cold, I think.
Well, let's see if we're hot and cold on the next one. Expatriate X-Men number 2, written by Evel Ewing, art by Francesco Mortarino. This is following a team of pirate X-Men, including Miss Marvel and others who are on the high seas. They have a prisoner. There's a lot of back and forth and spying and trying to figure out who the mole is. What'd you guys think about this?
Well, I tell you what, I have no idea what's happening, but I love the art and character design. And I felt bad for Colossus because it kind of looked like somebody left him out in the backyard too long, you know. But
he does look like a broken toy from Toy Story, where they were like, put a claw on his hand.
Yeah.
That'll fix him. Well, and like, this one does strike me as the one I'm like, wait, what's the point of this one? They're at sea, and when Colossus shows up, I'm like, oh, he feels important. But I'm like, most of the issue, he's not around. And Kamala Khan feels like she's sort of important, but also she's just... She feels so much like Krakoa Kitty Pryde that I'm like, why are you doing the same thing with her? So that was strange. And the most telling thing was Shinobi Shaw's the villain here in this issue. And he steps out and the dialogue is, and you are, and Shinobi Shaw says, Shinobi Shaw? Ah, fine, Shinobi Shaw. I'm like, really speaking for the readers here. Okay, fine. Yeah, Shinobi Shaw. Did you all reach in a hat and pull out the characters you were going to be featuring in your books? Because that's what this definitely feels like.
I like the art of this book. I think the action is nice and clean. There's a cool underwater scene in here as well. This is another one that, not to sound repetitive, really does suffer by, like, this crazy compression of doing this entire thing in 3 issues. Because I think... Like, this is almost the diametric opposite of what Evel Ewing did over on, I'm blanking on it, was it Extraordinary X-Men, the one that she...
Sure.
The Kitty Pryde Emma Frost title.
Yeah, in Age of Revelation?
No,
The Outside, yeah. I think that's what it was called.
It wasn't Extraordinary. Was it Extraordinary? I don't know.
I bet it was, because that's why
it has an accident. Anyway, that, and I know you guys often complained about this, but like, that was very decompressed and much more focused on the characters and their feelings. This is all like plot, 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 plot. The thing that struck me in this issue is this feels like this is supposed to be one piece, but with the X-Men. But in order to do that, you need to spend some time with the crew. And I think like... the idea of post-apocalypse X-Men sailing the 7 seas, fighting various evils, searching for treasure, getting people to safety, whatever, taking on missions, cool. The way this is doing it right now is it's all jammed into this very short space, and that's just not working, I think.
Exceptional, not extraordinary. Exceptional. So pretty close.
Thank you. There's an X. There's always an X. X-Vengers number 2, written by Jason Liu, art by Sergio DeVia. This is following the Avengers team in the world of Age of Revelation, led by Danny Moonstar. They have found a plot against the life of Revelation, and they're kind of working with him, though sort of annoyed about him. There's a little bit of a New Mutants reunion in the middle here, and there's a bunch of goop and things.
A lot of things falling apart.
Yeah, hey, what's up, Pete?
Yeah, I just had a question up front here. Alex, you okay? The kind of Vision Cypher guy got murdered in this. That seemed like...
Are you doing? What do you mean?
He's trying to find an emotional hook for you.
Yeah, exactly.
No. He's trying to find a way of needling him the way we needle him about Punisher, but it's very off. Because
he hates Punisher. He's 0-2 in
this. He doesn't like Punisher anymore. Vision is half Technarch. There's a lot of Technarch stuff going on in this Age of Revelation world, which feels very hat on a hat. Like, you already got a bunch of, like, viruses and babbles, whatever. We don't also need it to be the Phalanx Covenant at the same time or anything. So, I don't know. I guess to answer your question, Pete, I don't care.
Oh, okay. I thought the art was good.
Yes, I agree with you. It is, Sergio DeVia?
Yeah.
Yes, it reminded me of Jim Calliafore art, which really is such crossover art that I did like it. This issue, I feel like, has cemented describing babbles as the Psylocke psionic blade of our current era, where it's every issue from this event has been like, babbles, yes, Revelation has taken language for them, so they're all lost without language. I'm like, I know. I feel like you're killing. I want to lose my language the more I hear about what a babble is. I thought this issue, though, like, at least it was a contained story. At least the beats felt like it was a thing was happening here. The Vision pays a price. He gets to be a bit of the main character here. And it has a little bit of a mission statement, even if it is, like, working for the bad guy, sort of.
And last, at least, or most, I guess we'll find out in a second, Undeadpool number 2 from Marvel, written by Tim Seeley, art by Carlos Magno. Per the title, Deadpool is now a zombie some of the time, and Cable, who is part Technarch, if you can believe it, is coming after him. What'd you guys think about this one?
Well, I thought, some fun Deadpool moments. Tim Seeley is such a great writer. The shared bikini briefs line was fun. So great action, great humor. You know, Tim Seeley knows what he's doing. So in having him rock with the Deadpool and Cable is fun. But the techno virus thing got a little weird. But other than that, I thought this was solid.
I like this one as well. I do think this one has a real, like, vibe to it. Mm-hmm. Like, I think Tim Seeley does a great job of writing Deadpool. I like this character, Fearless, who is the one survivor from the first issue from the Alpha Warriors. Moving forward, bringing in Cable, I think, is smart. This is, like, a character that has a defined relationship with Deadpool, but is just as fucked up, but in a different way. And we're going to get that confrontation and that them partnering up in the future. One thing I forgot to mention, in X-Patriot X-Men, they make reference, there's an editor's note to check out Undeadpool number 3.
Yep.
And I'm like, a comic that comes out next month is going to explain what's happening in this issue a little bit? I was like, what? What idea? Whose idea was that? Like, especially when Undeadpool number 2 is coming out at the same time. I was like, that's crazy.
Yeah. I agree. I think this is one of the more solid series coming out of this event, just because Tim Seeley clearly knows how to pace things correctly for a 3-issue series, and also how to simplify it down to, for the most part, Deadpool and Cable, and that's pretty much it. There's not a lot going on the side, so... This is fun. The characters are good. I actually like the ending where Cable sheds the virus. I thought that was pretty
cool
and, like, kind of emotional. So this was my favorite one of the week, I'd say. And that's it. The Age of Revelation is over once again. Until next week, why don't we move on, talk about Department of Truth, number 34 from Image Comics, written by James Todd IV. And once again, Scott Snyder, art by Martin Simmons and Joshua Hickson. The backup story by Scott Snyder that's continuing is all about Elvis and the myth built up around him. Scott Snyder loves Elvis, so that's right up his alley. But the front story, we talked about this a little bit with the last issue, how we were like, ooh, it's really interesting how they're starting to, like, creep up on the modern day and really commented on. And this issue was like, this is about Doge. Like, 100% in a crazy way.
It's wild how this is about the modern Trump administration. Like, and that's a crazy turn. Like, because I feel like this book wasn't meant to be that. And now it has, it was sort of like spinning out of the age of misinformation that was at the same time as Trump's first presidential run and term. And now it's just metastasized into, it's like, well, I'm sorry, the world changed and we have to make it about this. And that's a big task. But this issue does a great job of it. But so I really enjoy this. I enjoy every issue of this, really. I think it's really smartly done, and the art is excellent. But, man, the Scott Snyder Elvis story in the back, this is my favorite narrative comic of the week. Like, I thought this was fantastic. What a way to, like, you can tell he loves Elvis, because he gets it, and he's able to synthesize Elvis's real-life history with the Department of Truth universe, and then also graft in this plot about, like, disinformation and, like, sort of upsetting American culture by ruining Elvis for America. Like, it was just so smart, and it's a backup that is just, it's just really excellent. That story is worth it for the price alone.
Yeah, I was super impressed with this. I really love the Elvis stuff. I thought it was great. This continues to be such a fantastic mix of incredible art and just kind of interesting ideas. This comic is smarter than I am, but I can read it and be like, okay, well done.
Next up, Trinity, Daughter of Wonder Woman, number 5 from DC Comics, written by Tom King, art by Belen Ortega. We have been following three different versions of Trinity from throughout time, trying to retake superpowered corgis from throughout history. And this issue, we get a surprising sequel to the earlier issue that found the middle version of Trinity sparking up a romance with Jason Todd right before he died. Another great issue of this book. Like, really sweet, really sad because you know what's going to happen to Jason, but still spoilers. Funny and touching at the same time. Spoilers. Hey, quick question. This is Tess, just because I was getting annoyed about this the other day. How did Jason Todd die? Real quick. Anybody?
The Joker?
What did the Joker do to kill him?
It got really fucked up, man.
He beat him to death with a crowbar, I believe.
Nope, that's not how he died. That's how everybody thinks he died. He got beat with a crowbar by the Joker, but he survived, and the Joker had set a bunch of explosives around a warehouse along with the woman who was likely Jason Todd's biological mother, and they both blew up before Batman could save them.
Oh.
Yeah. Also, there's awesome. This whole thing that everybody forgets about in Death of the Family, where it's Joker has a nuclear bomb in Ethiopia and stuff. It's like, weird story. That's
And it's but just anyways, funny yes. This is a touching story if you don't want to focus on the negative.
Well, I only brought it up because they mention it, like the actual things in this here, and then they tangentially talk about it. But anyway, go ahead, Pete.
Yeah, I thought this was a very touching love story and very sweet. And if you can block out the negatives and not have it interrupt, I think this is a great love story.
It's interesting putting these two together. Like, Jason Todd is such a, like, everyone's like, he's the bad one.
Yeah.
And I've come to like him, especially in the modern continuity. And this is very sweet. It's just such a funny choice, I guess.
Yeah, this feels like, honestly, it's written more like Dick Grayson than Jason Todd, which is fine. It's fine because it is very sweet and it is very fun. But yeah, it doesn't really track with Jason that much.
Also great art.
That's what I thought. And that held me out of it a bit. But I thought it was really sweet.
Devil on My Shoulder, number one from Dark Horse Comics, written by Kyle Starks, art by Piotr Kowalski. This team has been jamming out a bunch of awesome horror books over the past couple of years, including Cul-de-Sac and its sequel. Now this is a brand new tale about a woman who is taken and horribly abused and beaten, then years later comes back for her revenge on the men who did it. Per the title, we don't get much of a sense of this in the first issue, but there's also a supernatural element that is going to come into the series. This also starts with a warning at the beginning, letting you know that some really terrible things are going to happen to this main character, but it adds, don't worry, her revenge is going to be even worse. Oof. So that sets it up. Justin?
I was just going to say, you rarely see a trigger warning that pivots to like a, but watch out, this is going to be awesome. So, shouts to that. I'd never seen that before. And this is very horrifying, but like, it's a well-done issue. Like, I am excited. I'm fully on board. Let me say, this was the best Punisher story of the week. I would say.
Wow, cool.
Don't you agree?
I can see why you would say that. I think this is really creepy and really fucked up, but I hope the revenge is worth it because I'm on board, man. This is awesome. The art is really impressive. You can see here with this cover, that creepy-ass almost clown-looking like ghost demon thing there.
Yeah. This is great. I'm really curious to see how the supernatural stuff comes in.
Yeah.
Like you said, it's very harrowing. So if that's the sort of thing you don't want to read, totally get it. You may want to wait for the trade on this one. But this is a team that just works really well together. And this is Kyle Starks in zero jokes mode, in case you were curious.
Yeah. I mean, I'm curious to see, because you're saying we don't know the supernatural element. It flips to all revenge, I believe. Mm-hmm. I would guess next issue. Like, maybe it will become a bit more comedic. At least I think she's going to find a lot of creative ways to wreck these dudes that were so abusive to her.
Yeah. The Flash, number 27 from DC Comics, written by Mark Waid and Christopher Cantwell, art by Vasco Georgiev. This is another DC KO tie-in. As we found last issue, Wally West and Bart Allen are not in the DC KO tournament because Bart decided they should go back in time and stop Darkseid from ever doing anything that would cause the Absolute Universe of this tournament. They messed up, and now they're way back in time with a corrupted Max Mercury and Darkseid's Legion chasing after them. I know I keep big-upping, I believe the word is, Justin, this event.
Bigging up bigging is what up. I said bigging first.
Yes.
That is wrong. That is big wrong. That sucks soup.
What I really love about this is, like, this does tie into the main event, but you don't need to be reading DCKO to enjoy this. You don't need to read this to enjoy DCKO. But it does enrich the reading if you are reading both. More than with Age of Revelation, this is its own concrete story that is following the Flashes and doing something and telling us something about them. And I like that. Like, too rarely, if ever, do events do that, where you read all the tie-ins and you're like, these all work on their own, and that's good. Yeah. And that's how it should be, but never is.
Yeah, and even when they're using a lot of the language of, like, the Speed Force is screaming and all that stuff that we've heard, like, so many times before, but, like, it still works because of the connection to the larger event. Like, the Omega Force is taking over, and will one of them embrace it? Max Mercury's embracing it. The flip of the relationship between Impulse and Max Mercury is really interesting here. Like, there is a lot. There's a lot contained here that isn't just, you know, giving, like, speaking to the event sort of out of the side of your mouth.
Also, there's a funny moment here where, like, they're playing with this, like, dark side is, and it's like, what? What is he? I thought that was really...
Yeah, it's
fun. Yeah, it's a funny moment. It's almost like a who's
on
first.
They're having fun with it.
Yeah, Mark Waid, if anybody knows how to write The Flash, particularly Bart Allen, though he knows how to write Wally as well. And just, this is a really good, fun Flash adventure. I liked it quite a bit.
Yeah.
Next up...
Great action, great art. It's almost surprising you have it all the way at the end of the stack.
Well, something has to go at the end of the stack, Pete. And okay. We're not quite there yet. Next up.
We can still enjoy the books at the end of the stack, like perhaps this next
one. I'm just trying to figure out how does Alex purposely put some good ones at the end, or does it like...
This is the dessert. You have dessert at the end, right, Pete? Or do you have dessert first? You have dessert
Pete,
first.
Do you, have dessert you ever, always. You eat, and then you have dessert, and then...
Pete, have you had dessert? It's like sort of sweet stuff that you eat at the end of a meal.
I have it all like the it. I have it all the time. What,
yeah, when you wow, look at the shame in your voice. You're like, I have it all. I have it all the time.
I have it too yeah. often.
Every time, it's, if you're watching on YouTube, every time Pete's head dips down here, there's a little cake.
He's eating. Yeah. Yeah. Eating cake.
He became invisible and stole some donuts from somewhere.
Oh man.
He's a master criminal.
Justice League Unlimited number 13 from DC Comics, written by Mark Waid, art by Dan Mora. Yet another DC KO tie-in that also has its own distinct story, with Mr. Terrific leading a team of time-lost heroes into hell because Neron? I never know how to pronounce that.
I say Neron.
Neron has decided this is a great time to do his... What was it? Evil Unleashed? Villains Unleashed? I should really look this stuff up.
Villains Unleashed
thing and amp up a bunch of Z-list supervillains now that the Earth is getting destroyed. So great use there. Very fun. Very fun, like Suicide Squad, but with Justice League members where anybody can go at any time. I'm really having a blast reading this one, too.
What's great about it is, like, it's the off Justice League members. Like, you have Batman Beyond, you have Aquaman with the hook hand, you've got Blue Superman, you've got all the like also rants here. This is like the Exiles in the DC universe. I want that. I want this to be an ongoing title. It's really good. The expendable nature of the heroes is really adds such a nice element to it. Mark Waid could just crush this book as an ongoing. So, like, let's make Justice League Unlimited. The title works for this book. This book should just be what this issue is, and I want to see that.
Yeah, I agree with that. Cool cover. This is an awesome ish. Mr. Terrific flexing on the Snake Eyes lady, which is cool. Yeah, love the art. Great panels, love the pace. I thought this was a tight package.
And last, I guess we'll see if it's least, did I put it at the end because it's the worst comic or the best comic? I guess we'll find out.
That's
Justice League versus Godzilla versus Kong number 5 from DC Comics, written by Brian Buccellato, art by Christian Duce.
The Booch.
In this issue, King Ghidorah arrives and attacks the Justice League. Superman has been turned into a kaiju. Also, Green Lantern has some kaiju armor. And who's the third one who's large? I'm forgetting. Who becomes large?
King Kong's pretty big.
Oh, King Kong. King Kong is the third large one. Anyway, they attack the heads.
Yeah. They go for the heads. Pete, you have to like this one.
I do. Cool cover. Supes takes the owl in this issue, which was crazy. I'm excited to see what's going to happen next. Lex Luthor was just, kind of pulling some distraction work. Tons of action. This is a blast, continues to be a blast. And I'm enjoying this, and it shouldn't be at the end of your stack. It should be at the beginning.
His stack is our stack. This is the people's stack. And I think this is fine at the end because this is fine. This is just fine.
Oh, come on, man.
It really is. I feel like I've lost track of what should be a relatively
too much
simple.
Going on. Yeah.
There's a thing in the middle here where Harley Quinn is like, Batman, you got to help me find Mr. J. And he's like, the Joker's here. And she's like, not that one. And I'm like, where is this going? Like, I mean, we'll find
out. Also, you can't say Mr. J early. Everybody's going to think you're talking about Joker. I mean, what the...
Well, in the middle of, like, and Lex Luthor's like, we got to move on to phase 3. It's like, I don't know. The first one, what was fun about the first Justice League versus Godzilla versus Kong, I thought, was the relative purposefully dumb simplicity of, like, let's just go for it. Let's just do this thing. Here's what would happen. But with this interesting emotional hook of Superman and Lois getting married, potentially. Here we've had tried to reproduce that emotional hook with Barry Allen, who just got married, but I don't even think he's in this issue, if I remember correctly. And then, like we're saying, there's all of these other things going on at the same time where I'm like, I don't know. It's just a little too much right now. Maybe it'll come together at the end. I guess we'll see.
Let me ask you then, real quick, yeah. Alex. You're saying this book, which is titled Justice League versus Godzilla versus Kong 2 number 5, is too complex?
Yes. Perhaps
there's too many letters and numbers.
Man. Weird.
Yeah.
Slam.
It's like three heads fighting at the same time. Lots going on.
Yes. Oh, God. That's us. Guys, we're the Mr. J's.
King Ghidorah, is that what you're looking for?
No, Kaiju, the J.
Kaiju. Okay.
Maybe that's what it means.
Okay, Mr. I. Anyway, that's it for the stack. If you'd like to support this show and all the shows, we'll be patreon.com/comicbookclub. Also, we do a live show every Tuesday night at 7 p.m. to Facebook and YouTube coming
out. Sure do.
We would love to chat with you about comic books, Apple, Spotify, Android, or the app of your choice. To subscribe, listen, and follow the show, comicbookclublive.com for this podcast and many more. Until next time, we'll see you at the Comic Book Club.
And if you have a hot dog snatched out of your hand and you don't know why, only look to the visible man, Peter Page, who is stolen.
Oh, I'm going to steal your hot dog. You better keep
He's
an eye on it.
He's the visible man.